This is The Guardian.
Hi Pod fans, Football Weekly is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small town Welsh football club has finally been promoted to League Two after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham, all new Thursdays on FX. Stream on Hulu. Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. Manchester City lose a football match. It doesn't happen often, so congratulations to Newcastle for knocking them out of the Carabao Cup and making the competition a little more interesting. We'll look back at the third round highlights while previewing the Premier League weekend. Shobhaj Lai, an excellent name for commentators to say with a big crescendo as they rocket one into the net, scores a banger for Liverpool, they go to Spurs. Is Amrabat the answer for Manchester United? He stars as they beat Crystal Palace at Old Trafford. Can he do the same when United play Crystal Palace at Old Trafford this weekend? Chelsea score a goal. Are Everton now good since they beat Villa? Luton lose to Exeter and Ipswich come back from two goals down to beat Wolves. Also today, Susie Rack joins us ahead of the WSL. We'll discuss the FIFA agents exam. Guess which of the panel passed it this week? All that plus your questions. And that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. Barry Glendenning, are you now a licensed FIFA super agent?
No, I'm not. I wish I was.
Will Unwin, are you now a licensed FIFA super agent?
Unlicensed FIFA agent, unlicensed surgeon, but available for all work.
Good stuff. Hi, everyone. I'm Dr. Nick. Jonathan Faduba, well done. You've passed a big exam. We'll talk about it in a bit. Congratulations.
Thank you, Max. Good morning.
Are you now, you're now the next George Mendes, Mina Raiola? Who are you going to sort of base your game on?
Eric Hall. We want monster.
Yeah, I think... I'll go for Rich Paul. I'll go for the American model. I'll go for Rich Paul, the American agent who's married to Adele or engaged to Adele. I'll go with him.
Let's start then at St James's Park. Newcastle beat Manchester City. Happy when anyone beats Manchester City, don't we, Baz? I mean, it makes the competition more interesting.
I suppose it does. They don't lose very often. This is obviously the Petro Derby. Of the sports washing derby, whatever you want to call it. Pep didn't seem that bothered about losing, I have to say. And it's a competition he normally takes seriously. And I believe he was more concerned about the fact that nobody had booked a flight back to Manchester for his team. And they had to endure 3 whole hours on a luxury coach for the trip back. And that's really not on when you've got a game against Wolves at the weekend. Newcastle were probably worth their win. Manchester City were much better than them in the first half. Missed quite a few chances. Oscar Bob, who we learnt all about recently, he set up Julian Alvarez for a couple of chances, but he couldn't score. And then Eddie Howe brought on Bruno Guimaraes and Anthony Gordon for the second half. I mean, both teams fielded understrength teams, insofar as Manchester City are ever able to field an understrength team, and they kind of turned the game around. And Joe Linton, you know, his diagonal run through the penalty area, pulled the ball across the face of goal for Alexander Isaac, and he scored the winner. And I don't think Manchester City can have too many complaints. They weren't able. Their second half performance dipped and Newcastle raised their game.
I think, Jonathan, since we sort of said a week and a half ago, you know, that game against Brentford was must win, they've had quite a good time, haven't they? Gone to San Siro, got a point, perhaps fortunately, smashed Sheffield United, now beaten Manchester City. So I guess the way their season's gone, after their first game, we thought, oh, they're going to absolutely steamroll this. Then we thought, actually, maybe they're rubbish. And now actually... they're probably quite good.
Yeah, they're back to being quite good again. I think that obviously they're sort of built on this solid defence, aren't they, really? That's the key pillar of like what Eddie Howe's trying to do, which crumbled a little bit again the games against Liverpool and the defeats they had, and that was the part that was wobbling. know, they're not hugely sort of goal getting, even though they do have some good players up front, like Isak, who scored the winner. But yeah, I mean, even in the post match, Eddie Howe was sort of praising players like Paul Dummett and Tino Livramento, obviously, who made his first start for Newcastle and played quite well, actually. So it's very much a team built on defence. I mean, even the game in the Champions League, the Milan game, was sort of conservative display, I would say. I think for City, like, it's a bit like what Barry just said. It was almost like a feeling like they were more bothered about how they're going to get home from this game. I mean, it's like a three hour coach. So it's not the worst punishment in the world to get back from a football match.
You can't if you're playing, beat the rush, can you? Like, if you're actually on the pitch, you can't go at 85. Come on, shall we? Shall we beat the traffic? Will, were you bothered? Were you bothered, Will?
I don't want to indicate Guardiola's view on the competition, but City needed a goal and left Erling Haaland on the bench. So I suspect he wasn't too concerned about going out. No, I think once you've won the League Cup so many times, it really is the fourth tournament of the season for City. I suspect they'll be more bothered about the Club World Cup coming up. So no, I wasn't bothered at all. Had a nice night in, tried to make it old-fashioned. It was all right. But yeah, City were good in the first half and probably should have scored. And then Newcastle, once he made the changes, were far better. City couldn't cope. Generally, weren't having the same level of possession they wanted. Livramento was really good up against Grealish. He was coming back for his first start since injury. Kovacic was getting some minutes after injury. Calvin Phillips was making, what, his fifth start for the club in a year. It wasn't the best City team. They probably should have, you know, been ahead in the first half, as I said. But yeah, I don't think anyone's really going to be too bothered at the end of the day that they're going to have a few more midweeks off.
So I wonder who doesn't book the flight. Like, surely that is just, you know, everyone knows it's happening. Like, just, you know, Pep be furious. You know, who will he sack for forgetting to do that? Simon says, can we please welcome Oscar Bob to the Solly March Serge Aurier Club of Players, exclusively referred to by their full name. Absolutely. See also, of course, Benicophobia. So Newcastle home to Burnley. I mean, you can't, Barry, see Burnley get anything from that, can you? They did have their first win of the season, a 4-0 hammering at Salford in the Cup.
I think Burnley are improving visibly game on game, and a win will come, whether it will be at St James Park against a slightly resurgent Newcastle. I mean, obviously, they completely battered Sheffield United last week at Bramall Lane. I am cautiously optimistic about Burnley's chances, more so than I am about Luton or who are the other team? Oh, Sheffield United, obviously, who just mentioned. I think they're getting there, but it's taking time. And I wouldn't give them no hope. I'd give them a chance of getting something from this game, possibly a win.
Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, City go to Wolves, who got knocked out by Ipswich Town. I think they both made a lot of changes, as happens with most teams in the Carabao Cup. Wolves were 2-0 up. Ipswich winner was an absolute banger from Jack Taylor. My other observation from this game is Matt Doherty has an excellent mullet. I wonder if he's approaching the age where, obviously, unless, of course, you're in Australia where every other person has one, you are now too old for a mullet. I don't know if Matt Doherty is reaching that stage.
I'm just wondering, like, I've never had a mullet. I wouldn't want a mullet. I can't understand why anyone else would sport a mullet. I quite enjoy watching Aussie Rules football from time to time, and you see some absolutely splendid mullets on show in that particular sport. But yeah, not really for me, Clive.
Mm. It's the grand final, actually, the AFL on Saturday, when I presume the Brisbane Widgety Grubs take on the, you know, the Melbourne Bull Sharks or something, but best of luck to both of those teams.
I presume Collingwood are in it. They always seem to be in it.
I don't know.
They're the Man U of Aussie Rules. All my mates in Melbourne are Collingwood fans.
City go to Wolves. As I said, that's pretty straightforward for them, isn't it, Jonathan?
Should be, considering they have one of their best players play for them now, Matheus Nunes. So I think that's a game you'd expect them to win. City are kind of... they are kind of sleepwalking a little bit through the league so far. It's almost been like there's been no sort of discernible hangover, but at the same time, they're not sort of firing on all cylinders. You do wonder if, for example, anything was to happen to Haaland or Rodri, who didn't play last night as well, you know, where it would leave them and who's going to kind of maybe take the mantle. But yeah, Wolves have looked entertaining at times. There's cause for optimism in terms of what Gary O'Neill's trying to do in certain matches, but they don't seem to be able to string it all together for like 90 minutes, which is the issue. It's almost like they kind of stutter and run out of steam at certain points in games, and then regain it. And by that time, they've conceded one or two. So you would expect them to win, but you never know. Wolves on their day can be pretty good, but yeah, like they've lost their best player, haven't they, to City? So can't see really.
Must be so different. I think I said this on the last part for Matheus Nunes to suddenly just play in a team where it's just much, much easier. You know, just life is just better and easier. Pep was talking about Calvin Phillips, Will, and how that he hasn't got the best out of him. And he said, you know, Marcelo Bielsa gave Calvin the best of Calvin in his career. I'd love to have done with Calvin what Marcelo has done to him. We have our own specific way to play, and he sometimes struggles in a few things. Do you think he might come in against Wolves and probably more importantly against Arsenal?
I suspect Kovacic will play. I don't think Phillips did enough last night against Newcastle. And there'll be a bit more attacking against Wolves. And that's the main thing that City have at the moment with ball control and everything like that. They are dominating games, like against Forest until Rodri was sent off. It was right, quite hilarious how much possession City have. So I'm slightly suspicious that Phillips will miss out against Wolves, and it'll be Kovacic, Lewis maybe in there, who played last night. I know he made a mistake for the goal, but I think that's more likely. I don't think Guardiola's going to back him for this game. He's not picked him for so long in the league. It's more likely that he'll go with a different pairing in there.
Just one more thing on Newcastle. I forgot to mention Anthony Gordon, who came on, who's looked incredibly good this year and this season. I just wonder how close he might be to knocking on the door of Gareth's plane. I mean, we're obviously quite well stocked in those areas, but
just hope someone remembers to book the plane.
That's a very good point, isn't it? I've done a coach journey from Germany to England, and that is quite a long time. Next to a Welshman who talked about all the fights he'd had in Berlin. That's very strange. I was young. Anyway, Man United 3, Crystal Palace 0 in the Carabao. They play each other again this weekend. We'll see different teams, of course. But Amrabat played, Jonathan, and a lot of us saw him really come to the fore in the World Cup for Morocco. But he did look really solid in there. And that is a part of the pitch where Man United have not been solid.
Yeah, definitely. He sort of added a bit of strength to that midfield along with Casemiro. Mason Mount was back as well from injury. Crystal Palace weren't really the races, to be honest. And so I don't feel like it was the biggest test for Amrabat. But United did a good job. They had a lot more players back defending basically when they needed to. And then, you know, unlike the games, for example, the Wolves game, where if anyone remembers the start of the season, where it was kind of a gaping donut-shaped chasm in midfield, they were more willing to have players further back to helping out in defence, which was nice to see, I suppose, if you're Ten Hag. Some of the fringe players like Garnacho and Martial actually played pretty well and sort of staked a case for a first team place. I'm not sure how he's going to really, what he's going to do when everyone's kind of fit and available in a Premier League game, because you'd think Amrabat will probably start. You'd think Casemiro might start as well, and then that would leave Bruno. But then there's players like Mount and others who it looks like they may not get in the team. So how he kind of balances that midfield with Amrabat there is going to be interesting to see. But in terms of that game itself, the Palace game, it was fairly comfortable for United, which makes a change considering how they've played this season so far.
The donut chasm is a formation that I would... It's sort of not the right choice, I would suggest. I'm no expert. Yes, Barry?
No, I'm just a bit disappointed with Crystal Palace's approach to this game. I totally get that lots of managers aren't that fussed about the Carabao Cup, and I get that they have to give squad players a run out, but in the build-up to this game, Roy Hodgson said he was prioritising the league game against United at Old Trafford on Saturday. And I just wonder, well, why? You know, Palace are almost certainly not going to get relegated. They're not going to be challenging for a top four or five place. But if they focused on the Carabao Cup, there's a sporting chance they could get to the semi-final or final and give their fans a nice day out. One they don't get too often.
I think we have to remember that this is elite level professional football and they have to make tough decisions, and the League Cup is pretty much regarded as the fourth competition for, you know, the Champions League clubs and the third competition for all those middling Premier League teams. And let's be honest, you know, the final last year was United Newcastle. you know, there's no point building up the hopes that you might get to the final because a better team will still get there. So just go out in the third round. You can try and work out a week off, you know, if everyone can have a few days, nip over on the, you know, Channel Tunnel to France. I think Hodgson's 74, 75 now. I think he's quite realistic on the chances of Palace to get to the final. He's just like, no, we can't risk it, because then if they do have a massive fall and they're stuck in the quarterfinals or whatever, he's going to bin it off anyway. Bin it off in the third round. Everyone's happy. You know, you didn't have to waste a ticket price at home. No one went, you know, not many fans went to United, and fair play to all those fans that did, knowing that there was a little chance of winning. So
does this say more about your ambition, Will, just generally?
Well, I've got no ambition to ever reach the Champions League of football journalism. Very much happy to, you know, here I am on the Thursday pod, the Europa League pod. I don't want the big Champions League midweek ones, Tuesday, Wednesday, no. Thursday, Monday, that's fine by me.
All right, do you see this as a slight? Do you see this invite as a slight?
I was just trying to make a gag on the day of the week, to be honest, but, you know.
No, that's fine.
This is my last appearance. Fine. Bye, everyone.
Yeah, no, we treat every pod as seriously as the others, except perhaps like the Nations League third, you know, those are tough ones. But really, the tougher ones to do, we require the better panelists. I would say anyone can do a Monday pod, right? You turn up and go, yeah, that was a good result, that was a bad one, etc. In perhaps more serious news, Anthony's flown back to England from Brazil, has agreed to meet Greater Manchester Police to answer questions about the serious allegations made against him. His ex-partner, Gabriela Cavallin, made allegations of abuse via Brazilian news outlet UOL, which Anthony denies. Further assault allegations followed. From Reza de Freitas and Ingrid Lana. United have granted Anthony leave with full pay to deal with the allegations. Let's talk about Liverpool. They beat Leicester 3-0 last night. They go to Spurs on Saturday. Leicester and Liverpool both made 10 changes. As far as I could tell, Connor Cody spent the whole game clearing the ball off the line, but Leicester did take the lead. Jason McAteer's fifth of the season. He's doing well at Leicester, isn't he? Who knew that he was still kicking about? But Liverpool came back pretty comfortably, didn't they? Including a belter from Szoboszlai, who, Barry, has started the season brilliantly. And it's quite interesting how some players take a bit of time. Look at Anthony Gordon, like, really settling in at Newcastle. And Szoboszlai just sort of arrived and is brilliant.
Yeah, and that must be great for clubs to have a signing like that, you know, because you would normally expect someone to take a few months to settle, or in the case of Jack Grealish at City, a year, or the case of Calvin Phillips, he hasn't settled at all yet. And may have to leave the club before he settles if he wants to play regular football. Szoboszlai has just slotted straight in, improved the team, scored that screamer of a goal in off the crossbar, which they're always nice, the ones that smash in off the crossbar. It was a good win for Liverpool. They were very comfortable winners despite going a goal behind. And as you say, Conor Cody seemed to spend most of the game clearing balls off the line. Leicester keeper made a couple of good saves, and Liverpool hit the woodwork a few times. Diogo Jota's goal I liked as well. Nice little insouciant swish around the corner, sort of back heel. And it was, yeah, very comfortable.
Yeah, Yasha says, isn't that put away that Diogo Jota is one of the best players in FIFA in the world? I mean, I don't know if that's... he's really good at FIFA, or his player has really good stats in FIFA. I don't know the answer to that, but I'm, you know, that's the only Diogo Jota information I currently have. It was a lovely finish. Do you see them, Jonathan, as we search and yearn for someone to contend the title with City? Do you see Liverpool as that team?
I think they have a sort of underratedly good squad. Actually, I feel like they've gone a little bit under the radar, but. Spent a lot of money on the attack over the last sort of maybe 2-3 transfer windows, just sort of quietly with Diaz, Gakpo, obviously the Jota's there, Salah stayed. Nunes, obviously, last season they signed for a lot of money. So they have a really good attack. They've now sort of just about sorted out the midfield, added more mobility. So Szoboszlai seems to be the one that everyone's talking about. He's kind of becoming that sort of fulcrum figure that Liverpool always like to have. You know, I don't want to say a Gerrard-like, but you know, that bustling midfielder, the goal was incredible, to be honest. So that there's a lot more mobility there, and the likes of Gravenberch, Endo, there's got options. Maybe it's just the defence that they're still tinkering with a little bit, but in terms of how they're taking approach to the season, like I think they've got the highest expected goals in the league this season so far. They seem to have this tendency to almost be giving teams a head start with a goal and then coming back from behind, like they did last night, of course. So they've got that resilience maybe in and the squad as well to change things from the bench. So I think things are looking really good. Obviously, this weekend, the test away to Spurs is going to be maybe the first sort of real big test away from home. But they have a good record against Spurs. I think they haven't lost in the last 12 games. So, yeah, I think things are looking pretty rosy in Klopp's garden at the moment.
It's interesting with Szoboszlai, and sorry for any pronunciation issues there. I was in a roundtable interview with him about a month or so ago, and he was very witty in a language, you know, a second language or third language for him, I guess, in a country he's never lived in before. You know, spoke fluently. You know, you could see how he could, a man that could settle into a new dressing room, despite the fact that he'd spent his previous years within the Red Bull family. And so it was quite striking that, you know, he has that confidence, he has that spirit, that he is very likable, he's already adapted to England, he's not an outsider who speaks the language, lives two doors down from Haaland, so he's got a friend there. So I think that's obviously really helped him, and you know, the role that Liverpool have got him playing is, suits every attribute that he has.
Funny if you're the person who lives in between Erling Haaland and Dominic Szoboszlai. So if you want a cup of sugar, who am I going to go to? It's an interesting choice, isn't it? You know,
probably a United fan.
Do you? Yeah, possibly that would. You kick the ball out. Which fence do you want to kick the ball over? You know, it's going to come back with power from both sides, isn't it? Quick one on Spurs, Barry. I think a lot of people thought they would come unstuck at the weekend. They almost did, but they played pretty well. Obviously, the Spurs fan in me thinks this is the weekend they'll come unstuck.
I mean, is losing against Liverpool, would that be terrible? I don't think so. Maybe at home.
No, but you're unbeaten and you've got this momentum and you've got a point at the Emirates. You know, it's all sort of pushing in one direction.
Well, look, all Spurs fans will be very much looking forward to this game, whereas in recent times, it is one they would have approached with fear and trepidation and dread. So that's a start, isn't it?
Yeah.
They will be looking forward to the game. They will be optimistic about their team's chances. There's no reason why Spurs shouldn't beat Liverpool. They probably won't, and that wouldn't be the end of the world either. But I'm very much looking forward to this game, and I wouldn't be at all surprised if Spurs certainly got a draw, and they could win it.
All right, that'll do for part one. Part two will begin with Chelsea scoring a goal.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Patrick says, dear producer Joel and the gang, as Joel writes, about time I got first billing. He says, I'd like to inform Max that as of approximately the 15th of November 2022, there are 8 billion people in the world rather than the 7 billion he's previously stated. On the plus side, that's another £10 billion in potential revenue. However, it will mean that an additional billion tickets would need to be sold to achieve the elusive sold-out live stream of the Brighton show. See you in person at the Chicago live show in 2024. Regards, Patrick. Yes, we are going on tour. Tickets still available. Not a billion tickets left in London or Manchester, but some. Astonishingly, the Will Unwin anecdote hasn't instantly sold out the Northern Royal College of Music, or the Royal Northern College of Music. I forget which it is. But they're selling well, you'll be pleased to know. So the 13th in London, Ellis, Troy, Philippe, me and Baz. The 15th in Manchester, Will, John Brew and Nader Manuha. Yeah, come along. And the live stream, 22nd of November. And you can watch a week on catch up, all 8 billion of you. Go to theguardian.com/FWTour23. I mean, if 8 billion people watched it, I mean, I wonder what happened to the internet, but also it would become like, be like the biggest news story of the day, wouldn't it? I don't know if we'd been able to cope, Barry. Let's go to Stamford Bridge. Chelsea played Brighton League Cup. They won 1-0. Nicholas Jackson with the only goal. As many have already said, he wins Chelsea's goal of the month competition by default. But like, a win is a win, Jonathan. That is some confidence for him and for Nicholas Jackson, who is now suspended for their trip to Fulham.
it's a good win for Chelsea, but it's not enough, really, is it? I think on Sky they had the owners sort of trundled past, like, on Sky Sports News after the match, and really didn't look that satisfied at all. Obviously, there's been talk about them going to the dressing room and you know, members of the ownership group sort of taking some of the players maybe to task themselves personally, and the ethics around that is, should that be allowed? But yeah, I suppose it's just like relief, really, is probably the main feeling around the game, especially not losing to Brighton, who I think at least four of their players played for Brighton last season, apparently, I read. They actually got quite lucky. There was quite a few chances for Brighton early on where Robert Sanchez, obviously formerly of Brighton, was one who gave the ball away early in the box. And Brighton had a lot of chances, like really good chances in the box to kind of take the lead and didn't. They might feel a little bit rueful that they didn't take those chances. But yeah, Jackson was very pleased with that goal. He scored another one again, but it was disallowed. So,
do you think he celebrated for long enough that it should have been given? I wonder.
I don't know. No one really seemed to be very happy. That is my conclusion to that match. Pochettino looked extreme, like he needed a rest, like maybe a cigarette just to relax after it. Like no one looked that happy at all. So it's. I suppose Chelsea fans will be maybe relieved, but I don't think it's going to sort of ease the problems that they're having. I mean, I think they've not won many games at all in the last calendar year, so that's a good thing. But yeah, progressing to the next round of the cup is still a nice thing to progress to the next round of a cup for them.
It's such a low bar. No, I agree with your sort of. I mean, everyone's sort of confused about what they are. Will.
Well, I'm not saying Chelsea's recruitment has been a bit all over the place, but they did start with three left backs on the pitch last night. So they had Chilwell, Cucurella and Mattson. I've not seen it before. It's quite a novel approach, trying to fit them into different positions. But they've got three actually very good left backs. So, you know, maybe they should have looked in all the areas of the pitch, focused in certain parts and worked it from there. But instead, just put all your best left backs in any position and it might be able to work.
Or just play them all at left back, really shore up that part of the pitch. And all just sort of next to each other in a sort of table football style. Chelsea boss Mauricio Pochettino has been playing the crossbar challenge with Mikhailo Mudryk, Barry, to try and improve his confidence. I like to play sometimes the crossbar, hit the crossbar from outside the box. He said to me, I don't want to play anymore with you because you always win. And I said, yes, because I have the belief and the balance between belief and quality. I know very well because I'm 50 years old. You're still young and you need to know yourself. Sort of sounds like Yoda is talking to someone.
I'm not sure being repeatedly beaten at the crossbar challenge by a 50-year-old is going to do wonders for Mudrick's confidence. But it calls to mind the time Ellis James, our friend, did the crossbar challenge with Mickey Thomas, former Wrexham and Wales legend. And Ellis hit the crossbar with his first effort and it was on camera. And then hit the crossbar with his second effort as well, which was also on camera. And I suspect it was the happiest moment of his life. But just going back to Chelsea's sort of being overburdened with left backs, I think Ben Chilwell went off in that game with a hamstring injury. So he presumably now joins their list of the lame and halt and won't be there for the game against Fulham. And Nicholas Jackson obviously is suspended as well. He's picked up 5 yellow cards already. And none of them have been for fouls, like as in tackles. I think 4 for dissent and 1 for standing in the way of a free kick. And Mauricio Pochettino is very frustrated with him for, you know, picking up these really cheap yellow cards and getting a suspension already. But I can't see... Would Fulham pose them too many problems? I mean, this is...
I think they would. I think Fulham are good and better than I certainly... No, I think I put them 10th, but then I was... worried why after Mitrovic was going, but now Paulinho stayed. I think it's a massive game for their fans, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, well, it's kind of a meh derby insofar as they're neighbours and supposedly bitter rivals, but no one seems to really care. I'm not sure even the fans of both sides are that bothered about each other, but yeah, I would expect Chelsea to win this, but maybe you were right.
Remiss of us to mention Ellis James kicking balls on camera and not mention him hammering a ball into the groin of a small boy. definitely worth checking out. Brighton go to Villa at the weekend. Villa lost to Everton in the Carabao Cup. Is Villa Brighton, Jonathan, is that what? The battle for 8th place? 7th? 6th? What is this game? It's intriguing. I'm fascinated to watch it.
It's the battle for the Conference League slot. I think, to be fair to them, both of them are quite entertaining to watch. I mean, even if we look at the Chelsea-Brighton game, Brighton dominated the possession, dominated the shots as well. So it wasn't as if Brighton were sort of, it was a terrible performance for them, really. And it shows the standards that are at Brighton these days, how good they are. And they could maybe feel a little bit disappointed to not beat Chelsea away or not get some, you know, not qualify, which shows how far they've come. And for Villa, I quite like Villa this season. I quite like what I think they're quite entertaining. Diaby is a really good signing in my opinion, and I quite like what Emery's trying to do there. Ollie Watkins is sort of starting to maybe hit a little bit of form. I think for Brighton, having Europe is maybe a little bit worrying for them, in the sense of they've been a bit hit and miss this season results wise. Like, they're playing quite well, but they're kind of that final bit's a little bit lacking. And I think De Zerbi mentioned that after the Chelsea game, that kind of they're making chances but not really taking them, and so I'm not sure. I might actually think Villa have the edge in this game and might maybe fancy themselves to win, but no, I quite like both teams, to be fair. So even though it might be an eighth place kind of playoff, I think it'll be a good game.
David, is our Everton now good if we use the Aston Villa equation? No, the theory is over. It was good while it lasted. But James Garner, another for Dominic Calvert-Lewin. Some hilarious Villa defending in this game. But Everton-Luton will. I mean, it feels enormous, doesn't it? Luton lost to Exeter. They made 10 changes. Exeter have started the season brilliantly, by the way. Tom Carroll plays for them, who I think early in my pod career described as the next Xabi Alonso. But this feels big. I mean, I can really envisage a poisonous Goodison after a 1-0 scrappy Luton win.
I think Everton, obviously we see these occasions quite a few times, you know, when they beat Brighton away last season, which effectively kept them up, that they do have it in them to have good performances and beat, let's be honest, better teams on their day, but very rarely followed it up. It's not their style. But now they actually have two strikers that potentially could score goals, which is a very strange situation. Obviously, Calvert-Lewin's had problems with injuries last season. The backup was Neil Mopay, who doesn't score goals. So there's some positivity, you know, whether it's well-founded or not, around Everton, that they're being sold, which always helps when you get rid of an owner that you don't like. No one looks too far into the future of what the next owners might be like. So, you know, we'll leave them to it. So there'll be a positive attitude, two wins in two, players playing well in a formation that they're getting used to. The defence is a lot better. Branthwaite's come in this season and he's been an upgrade next to Tarkowski, and he's really improved after being at PSV for a season. So there's reasons to be positive. You know, last season, Everton's squad was just so thin and the formations were quite odd when they didn't have a striker available to try and score goals. So now they do have two potential options. They're going to be better. They're going to be a bit more diverse. They're going to be able to change things in a positive way, which is not something they could do very often in recent times. And, you know, Dyche is always going to get the best out of a defence, you know, and that's what it's built on. And now that defence looks a bit more solid, then, yeah, they're going to do well. And Luton, I mean, I think I said before, they've set themselves up in the market to the aim that if they do go down, and they probably will, that they'll come back stronger next season. And that's their plan. And, you know, they've looked decent and they've got some good players, but really Everton need to win this game. And if they don't, as you say, all that positivity goes quite quickly.
Just to sound the Sergio Ramos at PSG klaxon, I'm aware he's not there anymore, but Tim Krul is at Luton. Who knew? I didn't.
Did I know that? Oh, and I'm not sure I knew. I think I might have known it. But I don't want to claim it with any confidence, I'll be honest. Forest play Brentford. Will, you're going to this game. You've promised us a hot take on both clubs.
Yeah, you settle in for the next half an hour, lads.
Okay, could you keep it to 1 minute?
Yeah. Forest, a lot better than last season. Made some good signings. Arguably, probably one or two too many still. But definitely better away from home. Last season, they were awful. You know, I was at the City game at the weekend and they were very defensive. But, you know, anyone going to City is probably going to have them ripped apart if they don't play like that. At home, always been very good. The Cooper actually seems pretty close to having a first choice starting 11 in his mind, with Owen E and Gibbs right behind. He's just settling on a back four. Sangari's not had the best of starts after his big move, but obviously I think he'll settle and get better. Brentford, their defence last weekend was appalling. I mean, really bad. Nathan Collins and Pinnock didn't really know if they were coming or going, so hopefully they'll have been...
How dare you besmirch Ethan Pinnock on this podcast? Wow, that's very brave.
Yes, sorry, Nathan Collins was terrible. Ethan Pinnock just couldn't save him. So hopefully they'll have Ben Mee back to help shore up that defence. And yeah, I look forward to seeing everyone there. Come say hello.
Brentford lost to Arsenal. Aaron Ramsdale played, made some good saves. Mikel Arteta did some good sort of evading the question about him and David Raya at the end. Arsenal go to Bournemouth, who beat Stoke in the Cup. Sheffield United go to West Ham. And it'll be interesting, Jonathan, to see Sheffield United's reaction when West Ham beat Lincoln in the Cup, by the way. But it can't be as bad as last week. Could be quite a good team talk for Paul Higginbottom.
It can't be as bad, but the worry for them will be that possibly one of the best teams at set pieces in the league is West Ham, and quite a few of their goals conceded against Newcastle, of those 8 goals, were set pieces or from sort of those crosses from Trippier. So Ward-Prowse deliveries will maybe be giving Paul Heckenbottom some sleepless nights. They have to pick up at some point, surely. I didn't think they would do that badly against Newcastle, to be honest. I thought they might even get something from the game, just in terms of like Bramall Lane, thought they'd be up for it. But the lack of quality was quite worrying, really. And West Ham has sort of they've signed quite sensibly. I think Kudus has been a good signing. Ward-Prowse, as I just mentioned, like with his delivery, set piece delivery is, you know, something that David Moyes loves. So I would worry for Sheffield United, to be honest, in this game. I think they're not going to lose by 8, but I think they could lose by quite a few.
All right. Neil says, do we need a safe and well check on Don Goodman and Neil Lennon, as they looked like a pair of hostages being forced to read a statement at gunpoint while it was sold as the next round of the League Cup draw? I hope they're both okay and not suffering for their career choices. The draw is Mansfield, Port Vale, Ipswich, Fulham, Manchester United, Newcastle, repeat of last year's final, Bournemouth, Liverpool, Chelsea, Blackburn, West Ham, Arsenal, Everton, Burnley and Exeter v Middlesbrough. It's a long old trip for Borough, isn't it? Charlie says, no questions, just big congratulations to Jonathan on the licence and scholarship. Life updates, you tweeted. Happy to have passed the FIFA agent exam to become fully licensed under the new regulations. Delighted to have been awarded a full scholarship at the University of Liverpool to do a football industries MBA. My journey in football continues. I've just got to get a feeling you're going to get too big for this pod at some point, Jonathan.
Yeah, I feel like I should have probably tweeted that after the show, maybe, instead of before, to avoid questions. But thank you very much. Appreciate it.
So what's the exam like?
Keeping it brief, basically, FIFA have introduced regulations now if you want to work with players or clubs with an international dimension. So if you want to work internationally, essentially. So everybody who wants to be involved in that side of the game has to take an exam now. They're trying to sort of regulate the industry, which I think is good. I think there needs to be some sort of barriers to entry, because at the moment, Barry, you could wake up tomorrow morning and just decide, you know, you want to be an agent, essentially, and pay your money to the FA and off you go. And I've met many a person who's sort of like a part-time plumber, but also, you know, has a couple of players on their books or whatever, and is kind of doing both. So I do agree that it does need a sense of regulation. There's also the side where a lot of parents have started to sort of represent their family members, which I think in theory could work, but in practice it rarely works, I think. And so FIFA are basically trying to regulate it. But I think the problem is that FIFA have created a bit of a mess in terms of the exam, how it's held. There was a lot of complaints in Birmingham. I think 10,000 people registered for the exam worldwide, and about 1,000 of them had to cram into Birmingham to take the exam. The Wi-Fi crashed, the exam like was a chaos. So there's issues in that sense of it. And there's also issues in the sense that a lot of the bigger agencies, Stellar, Base, the ones who represent the best players in the world, essentially, they're challenging FIFA's rules and saying that there shouldn't be any regulations. And FIFA are trying to cap the amount of salary as well, that the commissions that agents can make. So there's a big type of battle basically going on behind the scenes, essentially, long story short. So the exam was pretty difficult. Some of the questions I had were nothing to do at all with working with players or working with clubs at all. I had a question about international friendlies. How many games do you get suspended for if you were to be sent off in an international friendly? Does it carry through? So the questions are really random. Yeah, I'm happy to have passed, and hopefully I don't have to do it again. But at the moment, the law hasn't been enforced in Germany. It's been deemed like not legal, basically, in terms of the caps. So yeah, there's all kinds of stuff going on. But the long story short of it is, you know, a lot of people be thinking, well, who cares, like agents, you know, everyone hates agents. But there's a lot of people who don't work with, like, say, a Jack Grealish or a Gareth Bale or whoever, who are earning a living out, trying to earn a living out of it, and kind of having their commissions capped, or they're being restricted from the ability to work with players. I don't mind the barrier to entry in that sense of having to pass an exam. That's fine. But I think in terms of the way FIFA have gone about it, because essentially in 4 days' time, if you're not licensed, you have to retire. So you're not allowed to work with any players or any clubs from October the 1st.
What's your ambition?
For me, I took the exam mainly because I'd like to move into the player side. I mean, I do work with players on a semi-pro level, so it's kind of like, right, okay. I have to take the exam, essentially. You can't approach anybody after October the 1st if you don't. So for me to continue doing that, I would have to take the exam. Longer-term ambitions, very deep question for a Thursday morning podcast. I'll have to think about it. But yeah, I'm doing the Masters just to kind of like broaden my knowledge, I suppose, and see where it goes from there.
So yeah, I'm sorry to pry. It's sort of interesting. It's more interesting than the Carabao Cup third round, I imagine. Like, so what, you could see yourself going into sort of football administration, or, you know, working for a club, or becoming a, you know, having an agency. All those things could be open for you.
Yeah, potentially. The Masters is kind of doing football business, so the business side of the game, which I'm quite interested in and would like to delve deeper into and learn more about. So I feel like it's probably going to be a year where I learn a lot more about what I want to do and really what direction I want to go in. And of course, like, the network and that side of it is quite important. And like I said, the exam, you can't operate anymore from October the 1st if you don't take it. So essentially, a lot of people are going to be out of a job in about 4 days' time if they fail the exam. I know there's legal challenges to it, but in principle, you're not allowed to operate. So I did that just to be able to continue the work I do in kind of like the semi-pro game and helping players transition to the pro game. So yeah, I guess from here, we'll see what happens, but for now, I'm not going anywhere, I don't think, yet.
I think Max is asking so many questions about this because he's quite excited to have someone on the pod that has ambition still. So, really just drilling down into what it must be like.
Might keep us on our toes.
Me and Baz. Yeah, Baz's main aim is to keep a dog alive for a couple of days. And I just, you know.
You know, you're absolutely right. It'd be nice to have us, you know, not just ebb away slowly to death. Here we are. We're now living vicariously through you, Jonathan. Like, really interesting. Right, that'll do for part two. Susie Rack joins us for part three. We'll talk about England losing to the Netherlands in the Nations League and the start of the WSL.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hello, I'm Grace Dent. I'm back and I've been busy. Comfort Eating, our award-winning podcast, is out now with an exciting lineup including Shirley Ballas, Bridget Christie, Jamie Demetrio, and many more. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to part three of The Guardian Football Weekly. The Football Weekly book is out today. You can get 15% off if you go to The Guardian Bookshop. The link is in the description. It is also this. Commit this to memory and buy a book immediately. Guardianbookshop.com/football-weekly-book. Available also from Waterstones and Amazon too. Producer Joel had a look at the customers also bought section on Amazon. Some highlights. A professional garlic press. Mr. Muscle drain foamer. And some Kerala Chinese salt and chili pepper seasoning times two bundle. So there you go. Anyway, we are dangerously close to being a bestseller, which is a real shock to all of us. So, like, please buy it, even if you don't want to read it. You get a lot of podcasts for nothing. And we have to sell quite a few to knock Richard Osman off top spot. He's a disappointingly successful, lovely man. But to be a bestseller, you'd get a blue plaque in Burberry, wouldn't you?
I was stunned to hear we're perilously close to becoming bestsellers. But, yeah, please buy it.
And, you know, the main reason is people don't buy books anymore, so you don't have to sell that many to become a bestseller, if we're being truly honest. Susie Rack joins us, Guardian Women's football correspondent, to talk about the Nations League and the WSL. How are you, Susie?
Good. Tired, but good.
Yeah. It's not like you've had a lot of time. I was just, when England were playing on in midweek, I was like, what on earth are they doing that for? It's just been a World Cup final.
I was interviewing three players yesterday, straight after getting back from Utrecht, and I calculated that they had had 18 days off before they had had to start football again from their last World Cup match to their first match. It was on Arsenal players, so Champions League qualification. And we were just talking about how, like, I'm not even ready for football to start, let alone them for them to play it. Like, it's, yeah, mad, absolutely mad. And the Nations League, isn't it, it's stupid timing.
Yeah, because actually, there's, you know, there are real fears about, like, sustained injuries and ACL specifically in the women's game. And, like, if you don't take any notice of that and people keep playing football, presumably there will be no players.
I mean, that's the thing, right? Like, this, obviously, Champions League qualification being so soon, like, after the World Cup is ridiculous. But then also, this Nations League window, which is coming 3 days before the start of the league, is just mad because it's the first time we've had a Women's Nations League. They're the first fixtures, and it's meant that you've got players being dragged back into camp after being with their clubs for a few days to play serious competitive fixtures where there are things at stake, because Olympic qualification for the women is at stake in the Nations League, as well as, like, European Cup seedings. So they're thrown straight into it, into competitive matches, whereas previously these were, like, somewhat meaningless friendlies that they could sort of ease back in with, and, you know, they've rested a lot of players and things like that, and they're not able to do that. So, yeah, it's just the calendar's screwed. All the players are knackered. Millie Bright, after their game, was like, oh, the problem is there's no end in sight, basically. And if there was some kind of, like, end in sight, that there'd been some kind of agreement on what the schedule looks like moving forward, it'd be a little bit easier to handle. But for the now, they've just got to get on and keep playing and just keep playing and keep playing. And yeah, it's Olympics next year, it's the Euros the year after. They're going to have five major tournaments in summers back to back before there's a summer off, and then a World Cup the following year. And there's just, yeah, the consideration for what their bodies can physically take, particularly when they're, you know, we're not talking about men's professional footballers who have gone from, like, for age five being groomed for professional football. These are, you know, they've gone professional recently, so they're not ready for it.
Are you regretting your life choices, Susie?
I'm always regretting my life choices.
Actually, while we're on ridiculous things, you mentioned Olympic qualification, and this is the thing that totally blew my mind, is that Team GB's Olympic qualification is dependent on how well England do in the Nations League, and has nothing to do with how the rest of the home nations do. And Scotland are in the same group as England in the Nations League. So if Scottish players who are good enough to get in the Team GB squad want to get in the Olympics, they're better off not playing well against England.
Yeah, it's insane, right? the idea that they've not put them, like, you know, said that, oh, they can't play against each other and put them in set, like, different groups as, like, the minimum is just, yeah, slightly ludicrous. Because, I mean, kind of, yeah, hilariously, obviously there's going to be players on that Scotland team that would love there to be no Team GB at the Olympics and probably disagree with its existence, who will go all out to stop it from happening. And then others who have been part of it and really enjoy it and really, like, embrace their Olympic moment, and it's their chance to get close to a medal than perhaps they would otherwise, who are going to be, you know, kind of almost gutted that they're in control of denying it. So it's mad. But yeah, I mean, yeah, England are the nominated nation. I think that's, like, how it works. That, like, only one team can be nominated to be able to qualify for it. But it used to be done on the basis of where teams finished in the World Cup. So, like, the top two European nations in the World Cup would be the ones that go through to play in the Olympics. But they've switched it into Nations League, and now you've got to be, like, in the top two finalists of, or in the final of the Nations League, or if France get there as hosts of the Olympics, then in the top three. So yeah, it's the whole thing is a little bit mad. I mean, schedule wise, it's time that they, you know, for me, switch to it being like the men's and being an under 23 tournament at the Olympics. So you take out one of those, like, you know, one of those major tournaments for the senior women's players in these sort of like back-to-back-to-back-to-back runs that they've got of like intense summers. But that's a very European-centric view, because for the US and Australia and teams like that, it's, and Canada, the Olympics feels a whole, they don't have, I mean, they've obviously got, they've got their Euros equivalents and stuff, but it's not the same level of competition. So like that for them, that is a big like competitive tournament for them outside the World Cup. So it's, that's the hard part, is it's, yeah, a Eurocentric view, but it is a little bit insane that it's not gone that way yet.
WSL starts this weekend. You must be delighted football is back, Susie.
Oh yeah, I'm buzzing. I say to the players, it's like after a major tournament and then a little bit of time off, it's so hard to get going again. And yeah, not really ready for football to restart, but it is actually quite an exciting start to the season. Like the first game that kicks off on Sunday, Aston Villa Man United, I think is going to be brilliant. Aston Villa have done so much in the transfer window. They had such a great season last year. Man United have had such a high turnover after finishing second. Like it could be a real upset. Villa beat Man City on the opening day of the season last year, 4-3. Real thrilling match. And on our pod, a few of us predicted that Villa could be the ones to upset the apple cart at the top a little bit and break into Champions League qualifying and stuff, which is kind of fun. And yeah, Man United are struggling despite all their many signings. So yeah, it's going to be a really, really good opening weekend with games at the Emirates, games at Stamford Bridge and stuff as well.
Yeah, Arsenal, Liverpool, Chelsea, Spurs. Presumably Chelsea go into this season as favourites?
I mean, I'm loath to predict Arsenal for anything, but I think they've got a really good chance given that they've not got Champions League because they messed up qualifying so badly, which is a disaster in like so many ways. But the last time Arsenal didn't qualify for the Champions League, they won the league. And I think there is quite a big correlation there between, you know, number of games played towards the end of the season and how well you do in the league. And they're going to have a lot of players returning from injury. You know, all those players that we saw fall out last year are sort of going to be drip fed back in over the course of this season. They've made some really, really, really strong signings. Amanda Ilstead from PSG, Swedish defender, who scored, I think, 4 goals at the World Cup as a centre-back. Alessia Russo, they've poached from Man United. Lea Codina, Barcelona, and Spain World Cup winner. Kyra Cooney-Cross, who's like the starlet of the Australia team, 21-year-old midfielder. Like, having her learn alongside Kim Little is going to be really cool. So that like, if anyone can tip Chelsea off their perch, it's probably Arsenal this season, given the number of games they'll have without Champions League. But it's Chelsea. Like we were saying on the women's pod, it's like, yeah, death taxes, and Chelsea winning the league is just a thing. So yeah, I think that's likely, regardless of what I think about anyone else.
How big a loss will Magda Eriksson and Pernille Harder be for Chelsea? I know Pernille Harder was injured for most of last season, but they've obviously both gone to Bayern Munich, is it?
Yeah, both gone to Munich. And I would, Magda's more of a loss from a leadership point of view, but Millie Bright has really stepped up into that role. Obviously, she's been captain in England. They've got a lot of captains in that side, so maybe it won't be as big a loss in that sense. Pernille Harder's like just such a, she's supremely talented forward, but they've recruited so well to sort of plug those gaps, and they've got Frank Kirby's back in training, having been injured for most of last season. So I think that there will be an impact, but Emma Hayes is so good at managing the turnover of players. I remember when they you know, kind of got rid of people like Karen Carney and Katie Chapman and a few of the centre backs, and you know, Eddie Aluko, players like that as well. And I remember thinking at those points, oh, there's going to be a little bit of a transition season here. And then there never was, because Emma's so good at winning while in transition. And she's spoken about wanting to do that. So, you know, Katarina Macario from Lyon, like incredible forward. Mia Fischel, really, really exciting young forward. American, has been playing in Mexico, but like one of the ones that everyone's sort of been watching around the world. In terms of like replacing Pernille Harder, like, I mean, they're not like for like, but that forward line is still really, really strong. And then they've brought in Ashley Lawrence from PSG, defensively. They have Kadisha Buchanan, who didn't have the best season, maiden season last year, but hopefully has come along a bit. So Jess Carter has obviously performed brilliantly for England. They've got Millie Bright as well. So in terms of like centre-back options and forward options available, sort of not necessarily like-for-like replacements, but that sort of fill the void in other ways, I think they're going to be all right. They look really strong, and they see, like, Emma Hayes is just so elite at managing those turnovers.
A lot of people would have seen the Aston Villa kit story. You know, this kit is too sweaty. And the sort of first reaction, you know, from the men's side is this is quite funny. Villa's male players have reportedly told the club the shirts are retaining sweat, making them uncomfortable. They had to change kits at half-time. Jackie Oatley, a friend of the pod, was sort of talking about it from a female perspective, saying, you know, she said, you have plenty to think about as a female athlete, just being the best you can be on the football field without thinking about getting sweaty, your kit clinging to you, both from a performance aspect, as it is with the men, but also from an aesthetic aspect. And as we know, women are different specimens when it comes to our bodies. Can really affect us how we perform if we're constantly thinking about how we look, or a top might be clinging to our breasts and also our body shapes. So it's sort of interesting to see that story from the Aston Villa women's perspective.
Yeah, definitely. It's a disaster. I don't think any player is going to be particularly happy going out onto the pitch wearing that kit for their opening game of the season, when particularly when there's so much attention on them as a team. It's the first game of the weekend, and everyone's expecting it to be really high profile. I would, like, if I was one of them, I would hate to be wearing that kit on that pitch in that moment. And I think I read that, you know, they're very, very concerned about it. I'm actually going to ask a little bit more today about it. But yeah, it's slightly insane that it's not been a consideration. I mean, for the men, obviously, but for the women even more so, for, you know, all the reasons we know, absolutely chaotic. Hopefully they can sort out some kind of alternative ahead of the weekend. If I was them, I'd just say playing last year's kit for now. But, you know, sponsorship doesn't work that way. So what am I to say?
Just a couple of any other businesses. Sean, on the subject of Spanish player Sid, said sounded like a cough, Victor Sickenkopf. And I introduced Linvoice Sinus. He said, I just wanted to add Magnus Headache, Richard Cough, Julian Vix, Ansu Fatigue, Yossi Benelin, and Phil Decongestant, which is terrible, isn't it? The last one, but Yossi Benelin will take. Paul says, we all know that Football Weekly is the distraction of choice for all things vasectomy related. I can also confirm that you folks are particularly effective when it comes to helping get through 2 hours of root canal work. Only a matter of time before you're being prescribed by doctors across the land. Great show. Cheers, Paul. Yeah, of course, we'll welcome all. Any operations you have listened to Football Weekly while undergoing, we'll take them all. footballweekly@theguardian.com. Thanks to David Squires, who drew a picture of Barry as the genie from Aladdin. It's meant to draw him as Jasmine, but it is a wonderful look of Barry coming out of the Carabao box with a cigarette out of his mouth.
Where is that?
I retweeted it. You can have a look at it.
All right, okay.
Anyway, that'll do for today. Thank you, Susie.
Cheers, thanks for having me.
Thanks, Jonathan.
Thank you, Max.
Thanks, Will.
Cheers, Max.
I'm sorry we bothered you on a Thursday. Thank you, Barry.
You're welcome.
Football Weekly is produced by Joel Grove. Our executive producer is Christian Bennett.
This is The Guardian.